Kia ora, g'day and welcome to the history of Aotearoa New Zealand. Episode 44, Māori Music with James Holt, Part Rua. That's two. This podcast is supported by our amazing patrons. If you want to support Hans, go to patreon.com/historyaotearoa. Last time, we had the first half of my interview with James Holt, someone who knows a lot more than I do about Māori music. This is the second half of that interview, where we talk more about modern Māori music, kapa haka, and go on a couple of tangents. Sorry, not sorry. Enjoy. Anyway, let's kind of get back to music. Yeah. We're on a little bit of a tangent there.
Always.
Yeah, always.
Always.
It's going to be the longest episode ever.
It's three hours long.
It's fine. You have to suffer through all of it.
I hope I'm interesting.
No, it's very good. So, let's go back to kind of the Māori show bands. Like,
yes.
I guess, what is that? What does that mean? How did they come about? Yeah. Tell us about Māori show bands, that kind of era of music.
Okay, let me tell you about Māori show bands. Māori show bands were like, they were probably the best thing to come, I would say are still the best thing to come out of New Zealand. Essentially, it was a bunch of Māori that, again, so this, it all ties in. Māori started moving into the cities and started being introduced to new forms of music. And a lot of Māori were very, like, one instrument that Māori were very good at picking up was the guitar. In fact, so much so that I would argue that the guitar is now a taonga pūoro. it's now culturally Māori, sorry, Spain. And a lot of these Māori had been playing guitar and were really into playing guitar, and they moved into the cities and they found out the electric guitar was a thing. Rock and roll was on its way up. The Beatles were some of the most, like, was the most popular band in the world. And so Māori show bands were basically groups of Māori, and a lot of the time they'd be like brothers and sisters or cousins that all come from the same, like, they all moved to the city at the same time and lived in the same areas. And they were essentially, they were rock and roll bands. I mean, they were definitely in that genre, but they had a very, like, Māori slant in the way they produced music, and they were more than just, like, a band standing on stage and singing. It was a full performance. They interact with the audience. They did tricks. One was the Quintickies, which is the Māori show band. They used to do a performance where they would, everybody would, like, line up with the guitars, and one guy would strum, and the other guy would do the notes. And that was and they would do that, and they'd get faster and faster and faster and faster, and that would be kind of their performance. They'd also sing, and they'd also, and do dances, and sometimes they'd do skits. Prince Tuiteka started off in a Māori show band, I think he was in the Māori Meteorites, or the Māori Meteors, I think. And they'd actually do skits, so they'd do, like, he would dress up as cushions down to make him look like he had a chest and put on a wig and pretend he was a woman, and they'd do, like, performances like that. So they were, like, big kind of shows, and it was ways, really, for Māori to make money. Originally, they were just kind of, like, they'd go to a bar and just, like, try to pick up an extra couple dollars, and also, you know, they'd go and work at the meatworks or whatever that they did in the normal daytime, but it was just kind of a way to add extra money. But kind of what happened was that some of their performances were, like, really good. Like, really, really good. And they were singing in Te Reo Māori, and Pākehā got very interested in them. And they almost got too big for New Zealand. They kind of were doing so many gigs, but there were only so many places that you could perform, that they ended up kind of starting to be like, oh, well, we could probably take this to Australia and do quite well. And a lot of them did. The Māori Meteors are a very good example of this. They used to perform at King's Cross in Sydney. They used to do, like, sell-out shows. And then they'd tour the Pacific. Some even went as far as the United States of America and did in Los Angeles. And, it's hard to, like, Māori show bands are a genre of themselves. It's really hard to pinpoint them. And I'd recommend going in and looking at, like, the Quintickies. A Poi Poi Twist is a very good song, if you've ever heard that. And you kind of get this, you get an idea in what they were. They were essentially Māori that took what they knew, so all the songs they were singing up on the marae, and that add in, like, you know, an electric guitar and a bit of a boogie and a bit of a twist sound, and then, you know, try to make a couple bucks, and it ended up kind of spiraling into this, like, really big kind of almost cultural, like, revitalization for Māori expression to the point that they were touring around the world. And what's interesting, I think, is that you don't really... Māori remember them. Māori remember Māori show bands. I mean, talking to some of my aunties, my auntie Liza, who's... you know, she's of my grandmother's generation. She talks about going to, like, when she was living in Auckland, going to see the Māori Meteors and how amazing it was. And it was kind of like, you know, like, it was, you used to get, like, dressed up, and it was, like, a big event. It was almost like going to see, like, the Beatles and hearing them perform, and they remember them. But if you talk to, like, the wider New Zealand public, the only ones that you really ever hear being talked about is probably Prince Tui Teka, but not as a Māori show band artist, but as him as a solo artist. But his entire kind of start was in Māori show bands, and I think was well was one of the reasons was that they were so popular as well, as because they had to kind of go internationally and perform, they ended up learning about what a professional performance is meant to be. And I'm not to disparage New Zealand culture, but you know, particularly in the 1960s, the New Zealanders' version of what professional looks like looked very unprofessional.
That still exists today. Yeah. If any Kiwi, I know half the audience is Kiwi, so yeah. You know, if you look at like Shortland Street,
right?
It's okay, but it's a bit of Kiwi jank going on in there.
Yeah,
right?
Like, you know, as New Zealanders, we know what is professional in New Zealand probably wouldn't look that professional.
Yeah,
in the United States. Not to say we don't do professional stuff.
Yeah, I just think that for overseas listeners, a lot of them will think, oh, New Zealand, like media, oh, they'll think Taika Waititi.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is good, but yeah. he's on another level compared to this local stuff.
And I would argue that you can still pick out, if you're a New Zealander, some cultural jank in Thor Ragnarok. As amazing as that is, you can pick out a couple, a bit of janky bits in Thor Ragnarok. But yeah, so because they had to kind of go off and perform overseas, they found out, like, this is what a professional performance looks like. Came back to New Zealand, suddenly they were like the apex of New Zealand performance, because they actually had to learn what professional looks like, and in a lot of ways they were the leading bands to kind of create a sense of professionalism in the New Zealand music scene. Because prior to that, the New Zealand music scene was, I think, janky is a generous word for what it was. Like, you know, you had songs like there's this one song that was like, the pie cart, like, bop or something. And it was essentially this, like, it was like one man in a studio that wasn't properly soundproof playing this, like, janky guitar, talking about getting a pie from the pie cart in Auckland. And you're like, Jesus H. Christ.
That speaks to me, though.
Yeah, of course. And, like, it does. And, like, and that was undeniably part of New Zealand culture. But it was so janky. And, like, and then when you had, like, the Māori show bands, it was almost like the music industry was like, oh, this is how you do it. And this is how we can do it. And, and I think that from there on, like, from the 1960s, you could argue that New Zealand music really started, like, upping its game slightly into kind of what we're... And this was kind of the catalyst for where we are now. I mean, New Zealand music now is actually kind of pretty groundbreaking when you think about it, for what we do. I mean, yes, there's the obvious one, like Lord. But, you know, you've also got, bringing in my phase, Alien Weaponry again. But you've got, like, a bunch of different artists, like Benny, who's kind of a new one, kind of came out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's kind of that, like, 660, which is just a complete and utter cultural, like, icons.
It's huge, but I don't think anyone outside New Zealand.
No. The world famous in New Zealand.
World famous in New Zealand. Kiwis will know that. I went to. I'm a Scarfy. I went to uni in Dunedin.
Exactly.
So I know who they are. I've seen The Flash.
Yeah. And actually, and again, 660 is another example of, like, you know, like, you could, again, they're not all Māori, but really, like, that kind of history of Māori show bands, of, like, a bunch of people that are living together trying to make it, which is exactly what 660 is. You know, people all living in the same flat, going to uni or whatever, kind of coming together, making music, trying to make a buck, and suddenly it kind of just spilling out into this weird kind of mass popularity. Mm. And that's what happened with Māori show bands, but, like, it was kind of this time of... There were so many of them. I think there were so many Māori show bands that there are Māori show bands that we don't even remember. But at the time they would have been extremely popular, but there was like so many kind of like coming in and rolling in and going to Australia and touring. And so yeah, so that's the Māori show bands. And again, Māori show bands did influence the Sir Howard Morrison Quartet, who I've also mentioned, which was one of our great cultural icons, Sir Howard Morrison, who is the late Sir Howard Morrison, and his colleagues. And they again were very much on the same vintage. They did you know, My Dad's an All Black, which is a quite a good song, or Battle of the Waikato. I'm not sure if you've ever heard that song. Honestly, if you listeners, every song, write a list. I want you to write these are all available, if not on Spotify, on YouTube. Search up these songs because they are great. The Battle of the Waikato is the best song, and it's based on I think it's some old American ditty that they sang during the Civil War, and essentially it's like, you know, the Battle of the Waikato, and it's like I'm trying to think of like the line. The chorus was like, we took a little puha and we took a little pork down to Otakuti in the mighty Waikato. It's like, yeah. And it's, and again, it's and they were, and predominantly they're performing in front of Pākehā audiences, but with again that kind of Māori cultural tinge to it, and also, you know, talking about the battle, like the Waikato Wars, with that kind of slight bit of cheekiness, you know, about, you know, about these British people trying to deal with Te Kuti and his rebellion and kind of stumbling at every turn.
For listeners, kind of the Waikato Wars were quite horrific. Again, to kind of fit that in, the kind of, you know, being a bit cheeky about something that's actually extremely serious.
Yeah, actually extremely serious. But you know, and it's one of those, I find that a lot of Indigenous people do this, or a lot of, you know, I the Irish are a perfect example of this. Of all the horrific things that happen to the Irish, there's usually a pub song about it. A very jovial pub song. And it's very dark. The Rocky Road to Dublin's a very good one, about a man walking from a small village all the way to Liverpool, only to get into a fight with the people in Liverpool and hating it there so much that he moves back. But it's a big, like, you know, it's a jaunty little ditty about him going to live in Liverpool. So, yeah, same kind of thing. I didn't really do research into why that happens, but I imagine it's just because it's a coping mechanism, if nothing else.
Yeah, that's how people deal with traumatic events, as humour.
Exactly, and I would probably lump in, you know, war songs as well in the same kind of category. You deal with the realities of war with a bit of a fun little song about it.
Yeah, I actually didn't write a question about
war songs.
No, I didn't. I thought I did. Ah. Let's talk about war songs.
So, okay. So, World War One, World War Two. Again, militaries across the world are very well known for their war songs. A lot of the songs that Americans still sing today actually can be traced to the Civil War. I think Let Freedom Ring is one of the most famous ones from that period. And Māori songs are no different. The interesting thing I've always found is that all this, like, old war songs to survive are all, in New Zealand anyway, are all Māori songs. There's no English war song that has survived to the extent that, like, Māori songs have. One is Hoki Mai, which is, it's got one line in it, which, again, and we sing Hoki Mai at, like, you know, we'll go to the marae and we'll need a song. And again, I want to kind of dig into, like, how dynamics work at a marae, just so we can humanize this experience. It's not fully spiritual, let me tell you. You know, you'll be sitting there and you're all the second row and third row Māori. By that I mean you're not speaking, you're kind of just there because you're there to support the kaupapa, and also you're hungry. And so you've got all the people at the front, and your uncle, he's really good at the whai kōrero, which is doing, you know, the ceremonial speaking on the marae. You can hear he's starting to wrap up his song, and you realize, he's about to wrap up his whai kōrero, and you realize you need a song. And suddenly you're turning to your aunties, your uncles, your cousins, anybody that makes eye contact with you going, what song, what song? And, you know, people will suggest songs, and everybody's like, no, that won't work. No, 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 that's too serious. No, that's a Catholic hymn. Why would you do a Catholic hymn? And then someone will go, why don't we just do Hoki Mai? And you're like, oh yeah, Hoki Mai. In that song, there is a sentence in there that goes, so when the flag of England flies over Germany. And we sing that. And the kaupapa, I don't even know what the kaupapa is. We were like, oh yeah, hooky mai will work. But why does hooky mai work? Because in one of those lines, it's like, the English flag will fly over Germany. Why is that part of the kaupapa that we're doing today? We just don't know. So yeah, hooky mai is one of those songs that really, really stuck. And it is a patriotic song. So the song is about, you know, hooky mai, te haki, te haki. You know, it's about, like, you know, kind of saying, like, you know, get, you know, we're getting on our way to go, and we're going to fight, and we're going to beat the Germans up, and we're not going to stop until the flag of England is flying over Germany. Again, very specific to World War II, and it was a song sung by the Māori Battalion. Another song from the Māori Battalion is actually the Māori Battalion had its own song, and this was in English, so it would, and I always found this one really interesting. So it would be like, we'll march, march, march to victory, we'll march, march to the end, oh for God, for King and for country, oh we, aki aki tino tang e. And these,
that sounds catchy.
It's very catchy. Very, very catchy. And so, yeah, and I really would love to do a bit more digging into why those songs survived, but part of my research did lead me to, so why is it that certain songs survive and certain songs don't? And I think the important bit is, songs survive if they're relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Songs survive if the people that are still around still like to hear the songs. For Pākehā, once the war was over, the songs weren't as relevant.
We beat them, who cares?
We beat them, who cares? Also, as a country, not really that into fighting wars.
Mm.
Unlike, say, for example, the United States, who became quite martial, and their kind of culture kind of dictated around the fact that they are the peacekeeper of the world. So, of course, the songs about, you know, Let Freedom Ring, Hallelujah, all those songs resonate with America as being patriotic because, you know, they are, that's kind of their role in society. English songs, English war songs, they survived, and that's because, you know, a point of pride for a lot of British people in the past was their empire, their civilizing mission. So all of these songs survived because they mattered, and for Māori, the songs survived because in World War II, it was, you know, the Māori Battalion came back to New Zealand as the most decorated military unit in New Zealand history.
Yeah, to add a bit of context to that, again, we will talk about this in the future, but I think they were the 28th Māori Battalion, is sometimes credited through a quote for Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, who was one of the most high-ranking Nazi military leaders, quite famously fought against New Zealand units in Africa with the Africa Corps, as well as being the leader of the Atlantic Wall during D-Day.
Yeah.
He actually, this quote is credited to him, or potentially one of his subordinates. It's not actually ever been confirmed, but more or less, Erwin Rommel said, you know, I could win the whole war if you gave me basically the Māori Battalion.
Yeah.
Give me them, and I will win this war for Germany.
I will win the war for Germany.
So the Māori Battalion is, as you say, it's the most decorated military unit in New Zealand's history, essentially for very good reason.
Yeah, very good reason. I mean, there's a lot of stories that you get, like, kind of offhand. Famously, the Māori Battalion had a haka. Apparently, and this, again, never been confirmed, a lot of Māori that had people that were in the Māori Battalion will say this story. Apparently, they did a haka before fighting an Italian army. The story goes that they did the haka. The Italians had no idea what was going on, and then they saw, like, this haka happening, and apparently they retreated.
Yeah, I've heard that story as well.
So there's this big story about the fact that they did a haka in preparation to fight the Italians, and they never got a chance to fight the Italians because the Italians decided that's just a little bit too much for me.
Which, in fairness, is fair enough.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, because I guess we'll talk a little bit about this in a bit. We'll talk about haka a little bit more in a bit. But watching the All Blacks do the haka is different to having a haka performed at you.
Yes.
As someone who, as I'm sure you will as well, as someone who has performed a haka and has had haka performed at me, it is an entirely different experience. Because I did it in high school, so kind of, to me it was 18-year-olds against 18-year-olds. To have fully grown men who very much want to kill you,
mm-hmm.
do that to you. And, of course, the Italians have no cultural context for what this is.
Yeah.
Fuck yeah, you'd shit yourself.
And also, like, and I think we need to preface as well that obviously all the haka that we see now aren't proper war haka. Like, they're not proper, I'm gonna kill you and, like, you know, and I'm gonna, like, display your head in my house, right? It's not those, you don't really see those haka. You don't need to see those haka because that's not what's happening. But that particular haka was quite literally a, I'm going to kill you, and I'm going to do it so easily, you won't even see it coming. and even though they can't understand the language that's saying that, you can definitely, as I bring back, you can feel that Wairua. can feel that Wairua bubbling up saying, I'm going to kill you, and there's nothing you can do to stop me from killing you. And so if you're feeling like that as an Italian, I'd fucking run.
Yeah, I'd be out of there.
I'd run as a Māori, quite frankly. So the Māori Battalion, one of the most decorated, if not the most decorated, military unit in New Zealand's history. And, of course, all of the people that came back with that military unit were very highly praised, very highly acknowledged. If you go onto any marae where they had people that were in the Māori Battalion, their pictures will be up there with the rangatira, so the old chiefs. They would put them up at the highest position in the marae. Sometimes they're right next to Jesus, if Jesus is in your top position. They were very highly honoured. And so, of course, all the songs they were singing were going to be kept by people, kept by Māori. And why did they matter? Well, they mattered because there's some very important ancestors in Tupuna that we need to make sure we acknowledge and protect. And so I think when we look at, you know, New Zealand war songs, and they're all predominantly sung, well, they're all Māori war songs, it's really because the ones that are kind of saying, like, let's acknowledge the, like, sacrifice and the work and the position that these people put themselves in is Māori. Māori are like, let's not forget that, you know, my great-great-grandfather went all the way to Africa to keep me and thousands of other people safe. Let's not forget that. And another kind of layer onto it was that at the time, a very famous Māori politician, Se Apirana Ngata, led a lot of campaigns recruiting for the Māori Battalion. And a lot of the discourse around it was, you know, Māori have suffered and Māori, you know, are being treated as second-class citizens. This was kind of Apirana Ngata's kind of point. He was like, look, we aren't being treated the way that we should. But go off, fight for, you know, king and country. Go and fight for king and country. And there you have your... That is the price of citizenship.
Yeah, so this is... I was about to say, this is what you'll hear in that sentence. Yeah. Is the price of citizenship.
The price of citizenship. This is the price of citizenship. We go off, we fight for king and country, we come back, and we are finally equal with Pākehā. Did that happen? No. And again, that's a kind of a point of contention, is the fact that, you know, Māori went to war in droves and came back and didn't receive, and not only that, came back more decorated than any Pākehā unit and got the least amount of recognition for years.
Also, on top of this, I believe the Māori Battalion was also one of the New Zealand units that also had the most casualties.
Oh, most casualties, yeah. You know, they died in the same way that Pākehā did. More of them died per capita than Pākehā did in other units. You know, and Māori communities lost, you know, many of the young men that were meant to carry on, you know, the kind of their place within Māori society. And they were being told, this is the price of citizenship. Once this is done, everything's going to get better for us. And unfortunately, it didn't. And so why are these songs still here? It's because, in a way, Māori are saying, we bled and defended this country more than anybody else. And we're still not getting that proper recognition. So the songs are here to say, yes, we did fight and fight until the flag of England was flying over Germany. We did that. We did march for God, for King and for country. We did all of that. And we still are asking you to recognize it. And so, yeah, so there is that. So I think that's why I really want to dig in deep around that music, because there is a, like, there is definitely, like, something in there about, you know, Māori kind of saying, like, I'm not going to stop singing this song until my ancestors are being properly recognised for the sacrifice that they made, and until my people are treated in the same way that Pākehā are treated in this country. So
yeah, yeah. As you say, it's still kind of relevant.
It
doesn't seem relevant, but putting in that context, it is relevant.
And it's not relevant in the sense that, I mean, no one in New Zealand at this point is saying, let's march for God, for King and for country. I don't think not many people are saying that. But it is saying, like, you know, this is what we did.
Yeah.
This is what we did, and even after we did that, you're still not giving us the proper recognition that has been promised to us since Mai Rānō, but should have been promised to us mainly because, you know, we are human.
Yeah,
absolutely. And we should be treated the same way no matter what our cultural background. So, yeah, I would really love to dig into it, but that seems to be another it might be a master's, I don't know.
So I guess to kind of, in kind of a similar vein, how was or is kind of these songs, I guess, used as a way of keeping, or like a record or archiving stories? Or in another way, would this be, or would, I guess, you consider this to be an extension of kind of the Māori oral tradition where, you know, the stories were passed down through the generations, and that was a way of, in lieu of a writing system, that is how histories and records were kept. I guess, do you think that the music that had been made, even like sort of during the war, and that is now sung now, or things like, even like things like Stan Walker, that kind of stuff, is that all kind of part of that thing?
Yeah. So the idea of like the cultural archive is very interesting, and I think as of music being an archive for information is fascinating, but actually is very relevant for Māori music. If you're an oral culture, you know, your entire history, you know, someone, not only does someone have to be able to kind of sing it and present it in a way that is remembered, they also have to remember it. And they have to remember a lot. And so doing it through song is a really good way of kind of preserving that information. And it's kind of one of those things where I was like, well, actually, pre-European Māori music, a lot of the songs actually were to kind of keep alive certain things. So Kāmate, which is a very famous haka, the haka.
The haka. If someone says the haka, that's the one they're referencing.
It's Kāmate. And, you know, it was, it's been, it's from Ngāti Toa. Ngāti Toa, it's Ngāti Toa's haka. They've actually, they got a Treaty of Waitangi settlement.
It's a big settlement.
So
I think as part of that settlement, we do have to acknowledge that Kāmate is being written by Te Rau Paraha.
So Kāmate was, it's been attributed to Te Rau Paraha. And it was, he was essentially in an enemy pā, and he was trying to escape, and he was hiding in a kumara pit. This is a story that I've been told, do not come after me. and I'm looking at you, Ngāti Toa. So he was hiding, and the enemy was above him, and so he said, Kāmate, Kāmate, will I die, will I die? And as he got further away, he said, Kā ora, kā ora, I will live, I will live. And that's the kind of main premise of the thing. And then actually even in the verses, you know, the translation is like, there is a big hairy man above me, and will I live, will I die, will I die? No, I will live, I will live. And he obviously did live. And so that like, you know, that was an archive. It was Te Rau Paraha saying, like, this is what happened to me. I was kind of, you know, I was sitting in this, but instead of sitting here and being like, well, I was in this kumara pit and there was this guy walking backwards and forwards and I was thinking, God, am I going to die? Boring. Put it in a haka. Put it in a way that, like, you can kind of express it. That's the way to remember it. And again, it's stood the test of time. From Te Rau Paraha's experience to now, it is the most well-known haka in the world. Actually, it's the haka.
Haka.
It is the haka that everybody knows. And people think the haka, they think of Kāmate. They're almost indistinguishable at this point.
But we should acknowledge that there is no the haka. There is many, every iwi has their own for various reasons.
And again, and people are composing haka, like, there'll probably be
almost
someone
all the time.
There's probably someone composing a haka right now. So, you know, that's a way that people kind of preserve their histories, and you get the same thing from waiata. So waiata, Māori did have waiata, but they were a bit different. So now they're quite melodic. very much kind of reminiscent of hymns. And this is because a lot of the influences on Māori waiata have come from the church and missionaries. Prior to that, a lot of it was very non-melodic. It was actually more of a chant. And this kind of leads more to the idea that it wasn't so much the way in which you were presenting it, it was actually kind of the words that were important. You needed to keep, like, kind of every single word to, like, kind of know the history. And that translates quite easily into, so the war music, for example, that I talked about, you know, for God, for King, and for Country, we fought, we died, and, you know, we need to remember that history. But it is also in other places. So in reggae, it's very important. French Letter is a very good example. And that actually kind of captures New Zealand history wider, but kind of done in a way that's music. So French Letter was a song by Herbs, and it was at the height of New Zealand's anti-nuclear movement, something that now New Zealand is quite still very patriotically proud of, our anti-nuclear stance.
Yeah, the Americans hate us for it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And we don't care. It's kind of our cultural quirk.
Yeah.
So French Letter was about... this actually wasn't in the United States. It was the fact that the French were testing nuclear weapons in French Polynesia, and one of the kind of early stages of New Zealand's anti-nuclear protesting was to go into French Polynesia and protest the French detonating bombs in the Pacific.
We love a good protest.
We do love a good protest. And also it was kind of New Zealanders being a nation big enough to be noticed, because of course nations in the Pacific had been telling the French to not test either, but they're very small nations and you can kind of almost ignore them. But New Zealand was kind of saying, well, no, hang on, this is our backyard as well, and quite frankly, we don't want you to be detonating bombs in our exclusive economic zone either. So French Letter is a good one because it kind of talks about, you know, the kind of where New Zealand was, the New Zealand stance against nuclear, and then also kind of saying, you know, the French were testing nuclear weapons in the Pacific, and let's not forget that. The French were, you know, there's a bunch of islands now where native peoples in, say, New Caledonia and Tahiti are still to this day born with massive defects because of the effects that nuclear radiation had on these people with the bombs going off. So, you know, it's also saying, like, let's not forget the French were testing bombs in the Pacific. And then you've also got other ones. So there's a song called What's the Time, Mr. Wolf, which was very famously in the... was kind of the main song in the movie Once We're Warriors, with Timuwita Morrison, a progeny of Sir Howard Morrison. same family. And he, you know, and in that movie, What's the Time, Mr. Wolf is... In the music video, it's really interesting because they have a bunch of important dates from the 1980s, kind of soul in the scroll. And, you know, one is the Land March, 1980, Bastion Point. And the other one is Bob Marley visits New Zealand. But the point is that, you know, he's saying, like, what's the time, Mr. Wolf? And they're kind of, you know, talking to Pākehā and saying, and it's almost in a way they're kind of saying, you know, they're kind of putting Pākehā as the wolf and you know, in the sheet. And kind of they're the ones that are, you know, you need to kind of be careful about, you know, ask them for the time, but, you know, kind of stuff like that. And, so that was a good one, and, like, kind of claiming history on, like, you know, this is Māori kind of waking up and asking the wolf what the time is and kind of, you know, kind of making a stand. And Herbs is another good example with, you know, Dragons and Demons. It said French Letter. Stan Walker, so in his kind of Aotearoa, which was a big one that he did for Māori Language Week, it's a very good song. He had a bunch of other Māori artists as well, and there's Rhea Hall is in it, Troy Kingi, Macy Eureka, and there's someone else who I don't really want to forget, but I've totally forgotten their name. But they're also really cool. And that song was, again, it was just about Aotearoa, but it was, you know, talking about, like, I think in English, the first lines is like, I am the water from the river flowing towards me, I believe is the, and the whole thing is about kind of talking about, like, not just Māori, but actually New Zealanders' connection to the country. There's a very famous saying in the Whanganui River called, which is essentially, I am the river and the river is me. Kind of saying that, like, I'm, you know, I am so intrinsically connected to this land that you can never in any way possibly separate me from it. This river is a part of me just as much as my mother and my father and my grandfather are. So again, it's a nice little kind of compact cultural nugget of kind of the way in which we view ourselves within New Zealand. So I think, and again, not just the Māori thing, a lot of people do kind of archive histories within their music. I think at this point I kind of want to say, weirdly, you know, Irish music is very good at this. Come Out Your Black and Tans, which is a very good one.
Yep.
Talking about, you know, and also kind of in a way mocking the British, like, you know, like you can go down to like South Africa with machine guns and fight a bunch of people with spears, but when you come over here with people that have guns, you run away. It was almost this kind of like taunting of the British. But it's also encapsulating histories, you know, like I think in there they talk about, you know, I think it's the Dublin Six, these young boys that were kind of hung for treason because the British believed that they were part of the IRA, and it's kind of it's still a big thing today of, you know, the British killing these 14 and 13 year old kids out of fear for an Irish rebellion. Another one is, again, weirdly, socialist music is quite good at encapsulating that. So I think if you ever hear, like, you know, there's a famous song that I quite like called Bread and Roses, which is a socialist hymn. And in one, you know, they talk about, you know, a million darkened kitchens for their ancient call for bread. And it's talking about, the song itself is meant to talk about the fact that, you know, women are just as oppressed by, I suppose, in this sense, the capitalist structures of work as men are. They're not just directly, you know, like when a miner dies, it's the woman that has to find a way to raise the kids. When the husband is striking to get better pay, it's the woman that has to try and keep the budget running for the food. Again, it's very essentialist, but it is still talking about, you know, a woman's place and how a woman is affected by the economics of our world just as much. And there's one line that's, the rising of the women means the rising of the men. And it's kind of, and so, again, I think a lot of music does this kind of like encapsulating realities and histories and then kind of projecting it out. And you can do them in different ways. I mean, you could argue that I suppose maybe we don't think about them in the same way because Irish music and socialist music are inherently kind of political issues. The Irish one, of course, because, again, Ireland is still divided between the north and south, and it's still a very contentious political issue. Again, socialism is going to be contentious regardless of where we are in the world, as it calls for a complete overhaul of the economic system. But again, it comes from that same, like, it's working class people talking about their experiences and how they see themselves getting out of those circumstances. In Ireland, it was about Irish Catholics, for the most part, talking about their experiences and how they see that they can get out of those experiences. For Māori, it was very much the same. It was about Māori experiences and how they saw that they could get out of those experiences. So, again, a lot of this is about how universal music is, but that, you know, that particular Māori perspective is not lost because the song is in a jazz format. Because, again, the way in which something sounds doesn't mean that the kind of core cultural principles aren't still embedded in it. Yeah. I don't know how to fully close that off, I'll be honest.
No,
it was good. I'll be honest, I'm like, I think I've said enough.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah. So that kind of exhausts most of the questions, or pretty much all the questions I had.
I have managed to talk about socialist music and Irish music.
Yeah, we've even gone a bit further, which is great. But you did, I hadn't planned for this, but you did sort of talk just before we started that you do have experience with kapa haka and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So I guess on the fly, I'm just going to start making shit up now.
Okay, cool.
So I guess we'll talk a little bit because, as I understand it, there is a difference between what you would call haka and kapa haka,
mm-hmm.
right? So do you want to talk a little bit about kind of what that difference is and why it's important? I guess.
Okay, so we'll start off with this phrase and then I will elaborate. So A haka can be part of kapa haka, but kapa haka is not always haka. There we go. Have fun with that one. But essentially, kapa haka is like a, it is like the kind of pinnacle, at least in my opinion, on Māori cultural expression. Me and my family have been very much in, like, kapa haka is, in Hawaii you have hula. Here we have kapa haka, and it is like a, it's a cultural institution, and it's almost like you have kapa haka celebrities that Māori know who they are, and we know, and the general public are like, who are you talking about? And we're like, oh my god, it's da la la, and they're like, what? Essentially, a kapa haka performance is a half-hour performance, and within it you have different categories of... kind of, yeah, different categories of performance. So you have, I talked about whakaeke, which is the challenge. You have a poi performance, which is a song to poi, essentially. You have a haka, that usually follows the poi, not always, but you'll usually have like a poi section, and then the, because poi are traditionally done by the women, the men are usually in the background swaying backwards and forwards and doing the bass line, and then after the poi, the men move up and the women do the, you know, a little bit of a kind of shouty thing at the back. Or they do a haka together, which I prefer, quite frankly. Women are way more scary than men. And then you also have... there's like a waiata aringa. Waiata aringa is basically a song to hand actions. And so you have... So essentially it's like different categories in this one single performance. So, and kapa haka would be considered, again, I've just described it as like the pinnacle of Māori cultural expression, and I've also said that it's very traditional, but the preface is the only thing, the only performance in a kapa haka performance that would be recognisable to pre-colonial Māori would be the haka. Everything else in that performance would be completely foreign, and the reason is because... a lot of it is melodic singing, which a lot of Māori prior to the Europeans arriving would not recognise. But also, it's very showy. It's very showy. Sometimes there's like different kind of circuits. So a lot of the time you're starting, your children start in kapa haka at primary. You said you did haka at
school.
At yeah, school, yeah. School I did, yeah. So you will have, so in Auckland, the cutthroat business of secondary school kapa haka is fought there at Polyfest. And you have some very well-known schools for some very well-known kapa haka groups. And it's a very serious competition. And from there, those people tend to graduate into the senior competition, which is, so every region... there's a big organisation called the Te Matatini organisation, which means the many faces. It's a big organisation that basically runs a massive national-wide kapa haka competition every 2 years. This is the off year, so next year we will have Te Matatini at Mount Eden in Auckland.
It was here last year, I think.
It was in Pōneke last year, and that was where Ngāti Manako took the competition out. They're from Auckland, by the way. there's some really well-known kapa haka groups. Ngāti Manako is one of them. Te Whānau Apanui is another really well-known kapa haka group. Te Waka Huia have won the most Te Matatini competitions. And... it's one of these things that, like, Māori view it as being, like, very culturally significant. But the point I always try... And, oh, there's also a more tier section, which actually is also... would also be recognisable to pre-colonial Māori. And more tier is... it would actually be how Māori would have sung most of their songs, is the format of more tier. I can't really... If think about it more as, like, chanting. It's almost like... monastic chanting, but slightly not in the same kind of monotone. It does have kind of inflection, but it is a very chant based form of music.
I think listeners may find more tier is translated to lullaby, I think, occasionally, which is, from what I understand, is not
if you were to pick lullaby in Māori, I'd say uri uri is.
Mm.
Now, again, if you were to hear an uri uri and you were to hear a mōtiatia, they would sound quite similar, but the difference is a subject matter. A mōtiatia is, if not a lament, is also a lot of the time mōtiatia is quite a sad.
Yeah.
So, whereas uri uri, usually you'd have, it would be someone doing chanting basically to a child, their whakapapa, and kind of all the great things that some of their significant ancestors have done throughout the years. So slightly different.
Yeah, but they would, just to clarify that, yeah, but they would Google it and it's like lullaby, not quite.
But but also, like, if you were to hear a mōtiatia and an ori ori, they would sound very similar. The only way you'd ever pick out the difference is to know what was being said behind it. So they are considered, like, you know, base Māori culture, but it's actually the development of a new form, or not so much a new form, but it's actually a development of cultural expression. The history of kapahaka is it started actually as a way to, well, actually they were primarily done when Europeans started visiting, when kind of going to a Māori village, as they called them, was kind of a big hot tourist attraction for Victorian tourists coming to New Zealand. And one of the things that Māori discovered that Europeans really, really were fond of was kind of watching us sing and dance, and you found that you could actually make quite a pretty penny from hosting performances. And so if you go down, Te Arawa, who are the mana whenua of Rotorua, you can kind of maybe consider them as kind of the fathers and mothers of this kind of performance. So they, at Rotorua, even today, still a very big Māori cultural hub, actually. It's actually kind of the centre of the Māori tourist industry. They would kind of have these performances, and so they'd have a haka, they'd have a waiata aringa, they'd have a mōtiatia, and then they might do a bit of a poi dance. And that was kind of, and you just do that because it would dazzle kind of the tourists. And then other Māori started doing it. And then along the line around the 1940s and 50s, he's going to come up again, Sir Apiranga Nata, who was, again, he's on a $50 note. Very big,
very
politician.
Important man.
Very important politician. one of the Māori politicians at the time. He actually saw that this was an opportunity, that actually this is a way that we can maintain our cultural practices, because it requires us to learn the language. It requires us to, you know, use poi, use taiaha, do haka, do mōtiatia. So he thought that this was a really good way to continue, to kind of promote Māori culture amongst Māori in the first instance. And so everybody kind of started having their own kapahaka group. My grandmother was in a kapahaka group back in the day. My dad wasn't in a kapahaka group because he was Pākehā, but my mum was in a kapahaka group, and all her sisters were in a kapahaka group. A lot of my cousins were in a kapahaka group. I personally didn't do kapahaka. I didn't think I was that talented. I find it unfair, because when my mother was at school, kapahaka, like, everybody was a bit of an amateur at kapahaka at the time. When I went to school, you had to be, like, a triple threat, like, Idina Menzel, Beyonce, to be in kapahaka. And I found that very unfair. So it was found to be a way that we can continue expressing Māori culture. And then it's kind of, and throughout that history, that's kind of what's made it traditional. And the point I did make in my dissertation regarding it is that we can't really view, we can't say that something isn't authentically Māori when it doesn't adhere to a certain set of principles, because if you were to make that argument that, oh, okay, well, Stan Walker's music isn't authentically Māori, well, okay, if you take that argument to its most extreme, that means kapahaka isn't authentically Māori. Now, say that to any Māori and they'll spit on you. I'll spit on you. But, like, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, you can't say that Stan Walker's inauthentic and then say kapahaka is. Because if we're going to play the game of what's most authentic, it's anything before colonization.
Yeah, it's a line in the sand, right?
Yeah. And it's like, so where do you draw that line? And I argue it's not fair to draw the line after kapahaka. In fact, it's not fair to draw any line. I would argue that if to be a living, breathing culture, your culture has to change. The only cultures that don't change are dead ones. So kapa haka was just the stepping stone towards another form of expression. A lot of people that were in Māori show bands, for example, started off in kapa haka. A lot of people, and a lot of singers now, started off in kapa haka. There's a group called... I've forgotten their name. God, I'm terrible.
You can tell me later.
I'm sitting here and I'm like, what is their name? But essentially it's like a bunch of actually 10 Māori singers, and they do songs like Wairua, and all of them have a kapa haka background. And so it's like, and to say that because these people are writing pop songs that are Māori and authentically Māori, that they're somehow diminishing kapa haka, I would argue, well, no, it's just a natural progression. And kapa haka has got its own place in Māori culture, and it's not going anywhere anytime soon. You know, kapa haka is one of the biggest social events of the year. Part of the reason why Te Matatini happens every second year is because the year you don't have the Te Matatini competition is the year you spend doing all your regional competitions. And every region has, you know, their own kind of top kapa haka performers. Listeners, add this to your list. Hātea Māori Club did a Te Reo Māori version of Bohemian Rhapsody. And they performed it at Te Matatini in 2019. And again, it's one of those things where I look at it and I'm like, it's so interesting because, like, what... Again, I made the statement, whether it's right or wrong, that any song that's in Te Reo Māori is a Māori song. Does that make that song a Māori song now? And you could... I mean, obviously it's a Queen song, but it's a song that has resonated with Māori. And it's a song that a lot of Māori know, and we've to the point that we've translated it and performed it in a kapa haka performance. And so, you know, it doesn't take anything away from Bohemian Rhapsody, but it also hasn't taken anything away from kapa haka either. So I'm very passionate about kapa haka from like a personal, like, It's just something that, like, me and my family have been really into. Every year at Te Matatini, Te Matatini is basically a week long, because you have the heats and then you have the final. And they're all in succession. So from day one to day five, it's like that. It's all day. And they start at 8 o'clock and they finish at 4 o'clock. So we, literally during Te Matatini season, we turn on Māori television, watch Te Matatini, and we don't answer phone calls, we don't answer the door, we only shower, we feed ourselves, and that's about it.
It sounds like my stepdad when he watches Bathurst.
Yes! Or my father when he watched cricket.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that, yeah, wow. That is... I don't know.
Honestly, you're gonna have so many episodes on music alone. I feel like, God. I mean, if I were to advise you... Which I don't presume to do, but like I think if you did like a music episode kind of in every kind of, I don't know where it's important, because I think if you did a music episode for every decade that you did when you get to contemporary music,
we might have to do that, I think.
Well, again, like, it's just the amount of things that came out of New Zealand. Like, I haven't even talked about like the Shona Langs or we haven't even talked about, like, kind of the first New Zealand song, which is a song called Blue Smoke. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of it.
No.
If you hear it, it sounds Hawaiian. It sounds very Hawaiian, but that's because a lot of American producers came down to New Zealand to record music, and they were like, oh, what are Māori going to sound like? I know, those sound like Hawaiians.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, if you hear Blue Smoke, you hear it, and you think, oh, this lovely Hawaiian song. But it was produced. Mm. It was sung by a Māori woman. It was produced here in New Zealand, and it was sold and recorded and stuff in New Zealand. So, yeah, I think... And again, there's also Flying Nun. Mm-hmm. If you've ever, you know, like that recording studio down in Dunedin that produced some very interesting characters. And even in the 1960s there was a show called Come On.
Oh yeah.
It was this old song on NZBC which basically you'd have like I think I'd do up to like 8 different artists singing a new song, and it was almost every week they'd have like 8 different artists, and they'd all produce like their own songs. And there was it was the most famous line, because it was something along the lines of like, it's a happening scene on your TV screen, and here's what we mean, and then they'd immediately go into this new song. So you'll need to talk about that. I mean, I'm very much in the fact that like a lot of New Zealand music history isn't talked about, but we need to talk about it because we do produce some pretty out there music performers. I mean, Shona Lang did a song called Soviet Snow. And I think the other song she did was I'm Glad I'm Not a Kennedy. And essentially it was her kind of talking. And it was the New Zealander just kind of discussing, you know, from her perspective, the problems that are facing the world. Like Soviet Snow was about, you know, there'd be a heave of Soviet snow. It was about, you know, the kind of the geopolitical war between the Soviets and the United States, and actually why is that a thing, and why does that need to happen? And Glad I'm Not a Kennedy was about, you know, so many people with the last name Kennedy are being killed left, right and centre, mainly because of what they advocate. And if that's how you run your political system, that seems to be a bit of a problem. So I always find it interesting when you hear songs like that by New Zealanders, almost kind of critiquing the world around them and being like, why can't we just get along? But in a way, that's not even very, like, it wasn't even a very happy way. It wasn't like it wasn't like a Woodstock kind of, it was like techno music that we did. And I always find it interesting how New Zealanders in some ways had the audacity to comment about geopolitics. Like, who are we?
We're just this random country to bomb the South.
But I think it speaks as well to that kind of independent kind of foreign policy that politicians to this day are very keen to point out. You know, like, even Jacinda now is always talking about, you know, oh, we have an independent foreign policy, and never really elaborate what that means. But for but realistically, what it means is like we're just going to do what we're going to do, and we're going to make sure. And essentially, our diplomatic policy is don't piss anybody off, but don't get too friendly with someone that if they're pissed off, we have to pick a side. And so it's almost like Swiss neutrality, but hoping that the world just ignores us.
Well, we're left on a lot of maps, so, you know.
I mean, yeah. I mean, when there was that campaign to get New Zealand on the maps, I'm like, honestly, keep us off. That's fine. We can just sit here by ourselves. But no, so honestly, New Zealand music, if you have your own time, because honestly, I guarantee these episodes are going to be few and far between.
Yeah, no, we're not going to return to, I think, music in general for quite some time yet. Probably not until the 20th century, I think.
Yeah, well, there's not much that happens kind of in between. There's kind of the church songs. Sea shanties were very big.
I love a good
sea shanty. Apparently, it's interesting that in a lot of my study, you know, that there was a separate category that Māori, because Māori liked to kind of dictate what the music was. Like, haka was a certain thing, motiti was a certain thing, oriori was a certain thing. There's even a genre of music that seems very specific to me, but I have nothing else to challenge it as being a specific genre. Apparently it was a genre specifically for women calling out men that have slighted them. And a lot of the music would be, you know, like, for example, like if a man said, oh, I've already slept with that woman and she's not even that good, she'd come out and be like, you know, no, you haven't slept with me and I would never sleep with you because your dick's too small. Like, it was that kind of, and also remembering that for pre-colonial Māori society, music wasn't like a separate thing. You did it kind of whenever the need arose. So you did a haka when you felt like you needed to do a haka. You did whatever genre that song was when, as soon as you heard the man slight you, you'd think, right, I'm composing this song. I'm composing it right now. I'm ad hocking this song right now, bastard's going to hear me talk about his small dick. Or even there's like a lot of songs about like women who had lost their husbands going to their brothers that are rangatira, and kind of doing a motiatia lament outside the pa until their brother comes down to, I guess, ask what the hell's wrong, what the hell's wrong with you. But not in a way that's like, and I think that intrinsicness of musical expression is something that's different from European society, but I also don't really want to say that because, of course, European cultures had a long tradition of folk music, and a lot of the songs, say, like in the American South or the American Midwest, you know, the old kind of folk songs, they were, or even actually even talking about socialist music, a lot of those songs were actually based on folk songs and people, like, you know, miners or people on chain gangs singing about their woes. So I think it, like, you know, to say that in Māori society music was intrinsic, it's true, but let's not forget that, like, actually, music was intrinsic amongst a lot of cultures, and folk expression was really, really big. It was probably not until really the church with their hymns, and then until the Enlightenment, where kind of composers were the kind of, you know, like the Bachs and the Beethovens, where music started to be like it was kind of performed in a controlled. Like, you know, here's the audience, here's the performers, I'm going to play a song, you're going to enjoy it, you're going to clap, you're going to leave, I'm going to leave, and I make some money. But really, you know, folk music, it was just people kind of sitting around a fire, getting on the piss, and then being classic. Like, I feel like I need to sing a song about how I'm on the piss.
Classic.
So, yeah. So, I think, you know, that exists today.
Yeah. I mean, that is just Kiwi culture, isn't it?
Well, again, as I talked about very early on in this interview, the garage party.
Yeah.
I mean, it essentially is just all getting on the piss and saying, who wants to hear an old war song? And for whatever reason, we all go, fuck yeah, play it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And actually, some things I just want to kind of mention on the tail end, which didn't really fit in, but, like, there are things like the Māori strum. I'm not sure if you've ever heard.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's like a particular strum you do on the guitar that's considered the Māori strum. You've also got the four-chord Māori harmony, which is play any of these four chords in any random order and you can sing any song in the world. Not necessarily true. But if that uncle will be playing the same four chords and you're singing every song from Born This Way by Lady Gaga to, again, and I'm just going to round it off, Stupid Cupid by Connie Francis. That song has followed me forever.
I think with that, we might leave it there or start to wrap up a little bit.
I mean, just as some, like, environmental commentary, like, it has gone dark.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm actually not facing the window, so I haven't actually seen behind me. We've been here for a while.
I've literally been sitting here seeing the hours slowly pour through the hourglass.
Yeah, the Zoom which we're using to record this says we've been at this for 2 hours. Keep in mind, we were at this for about
three-ish hours
before we actually started recording.
And also before that, we were doing an hour at a coffee shop.
Yes, it's been an afternoon.
Because we saw each other at 1, didn't we? What's the time now?
It is 6:20.
Love that.
So at the top of the episode, you probably heard me say it was 4:15. It's now 6:20. This might need to be 2 episodes, but that's okay.
I'm so sorry, listeners, you get 2 episodes of me.
That's perfectly fine. It has been very, very interesting. So just to kind of, I guess... before we fully close it out,
yeah.
Since we got you, and there are, this is a platform people listen to. Is there any causes or projects, etc., that you want to promote?
Oh God, you should have told me this earlier. Oh,
sorry,
you should have told me this earlier. No, you know what? Actually, there's only one at the moment that really comes to mind, and you've already talked about this. It's Black Lives Matter. It's like it's the protest movement that's sweeping the nation, and for good reason. It's sweeping the world, actually.
We have protests here in New Zealand.
We have protests here in New Zealand. I implore anybody, literally anybody, to get on board with this kaupapa. It's a very important one. It's about safety. It's about safety for all of us, and it's about, you know, treating people equally. And I'm sitting here talking about it as if I don't want to offend anybody, but this is not an offensive movement. Like, when I say Black Lives Matter, I also mean, like, it's obviously all lives matter, but Black Lives Matter, and we need to make sure that need to make sure that our governments and our police are ensuring that everybody's being treated equally, because everybody has the right to feel safe in their communities and to be able to ask for help if they feel unsafe.
Fantastic. And with that, I think we will call it there. So thank you very much, James, for joining me on this.
And thank you for having me.
It has, I've really enjoyed it. I feel like I've learned a lot. I hope everyone else has as well, because it's, as I said kind of a bit earlier, it's nice to get someone in who's got a different perspective, has looked at it differently from a different series of angles and that kind of stuff. So that's very, very interesting. So.
And also, like, just as a point to anybody that's listening, because again, I am a listener of the podcast. If you have any knowledge, if you have any expert knowledge on New Zealand history, message this fella, and you too may get an interview.
You may get an no guarantees.
No guarantees. Yeah, you do have to be in the Wellington region.
Well, you don't. Through the modern technology, we can just
and
Skype,
actually we and I have to, and we have all been doing a good Zoom, haven't
do
we?
Do good Zoom. This. We love a good Zoom.
Oh God!
Now, but yes, no. If you do have similar knowledge of something or other, you please get in contact. But I don't want any Tom, Dick, or Harry getting on.
No,
you actually got to know what you're talking about, I'm
right.
afraid.
Yeah,
you actually do kind of need to have some sort of background and qualification in it, which I know is rich coming from a guy with a conservation degree, but
hey important kaupapa.
but yes, no, if you do have some sort of knowledge, some sort of background in anything to do with New Zealand, doesn't matter if it New Zealand history, it doesn't matter if it's within or without of the chronology that we're in at the moment, it just so happened that it works at the moment.
It really does work at the moment.
But you know, if you've got something from 20th century, 19th century, whatever it is, yeah, hit me up. But with that, I think we better cut it off.
Otherwise, I'm never getting home.
Yes. So thank you very much again. And we will see you in the next one.
Ka kite.
I would just like to once again thank James for coming on to Hans and chatting to me all about his research and generally just being an all-round GC. It was a pleasure to talk with him, being full of knowledge and a bloody good laugh. I hope you have enjoyed listening to us chinwag and learned something new from it. Next time. It's another interview! Not about music this time, but we actually go back a little to our Tā Moko episodes earlier in the year. I talk to Te Herekeke Hiriwini, head of the repatriation team at New Zealand's National Museum, Te Papa. We discuss all about what is involved with the returning of Māori and Moriori remains from overseas back to Aotearoa, given many were taken for various reasons during European colonisation. It's another really interesting interview, and I'm very much looking forward to sharing it with you. If you want to send me feedback, ask a question, suggest a topic, or just have a chinwag, you can reach me through email at historyaotearoa@gmail.com or Twitter at historyaotearoa or Facebook at historyaotearoa New Zealand Podcast. Aotearoa spelt Aotearoa. This podcast is a one-man band. If you enjoy listening to me talk history, you can support us through Patreon, buy merch from historyaotearoa.com, or give us a review. It means a lot and helps spread the story of Aotearoa New Zealand. As always, haere tū atu, hoki tū mai. See you next time.